Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 66. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, Peter Sawtell, Executive Director of Echo Justice Ministries. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue after the interview. One of the most shocking of Peter Sawtell's recent weekly commentaries was "More Plastic Than Fish." I'll link to it in the show notes. In short, he says, by 2050, the Earth's oceans are expected to contain more plastics than fish. That's the shocking prediction from a recent report, and judging by how often and how widely I've heard it quoted, it is a figure that has captured our imagination. It is a vivid image of humanity's enormous and devastating impact on the planet. The statistic by itself: in just 34 years, plastic trash in the ocean will outweigh all the fish in the sea, might nudge us toward hopelessness and despair. Fortunately, the new report from the World Economic Forum deals with careful analysis and creative options that point towards solutions. I spoke to Peter way back in episode 18, which is linked in the show notes, so it's good to get an update from him. He's really on the front lines of the environmental movement. Remember, one of the five life standards of living more with less is care for the natural order. That is, cherish the natural order, which basically means care for creation. Well, it's been a couple of years since we've had a chance to talk to Peter Sawtell, Executive Director of Echo Justice Ministries. He's an ordained pastor in the United Church of Christ and is the founder of Echo Justice Ministries. Last time we talked about his new campaign called Not Ordinary Times. And we'll be talking, getting an update on that as well. But so much has happened in the Echo Justice, the environmental justice, the creation crisis justice movement since then, that I'm going to ask for his digest a summary of bringing us up to date, and then we're going to talk specifically about feelings of anxiety. So, Peter, take it away. Start wherever you'd like.
Thank you, Gerald. It's great to be back in conversation with you and your podcast audience, and I really appreciate the invitation to be with you again. You tossed out a very large question there about what's going on in the eco-justice movement, and more particularly from my perspective on the faith-based environmental movement. I guess I'd have to say that even more so in the last 2 years, the emphasis has been very, very strongly on the climate justice aspect. There's certainly concerns about endangered species and toxic waste and a slew of other issues. But we are all deeply, deeply concerned about the rapid change in our global climate. And we are working to get faith-based communities and the broader political system to rally up and pay attention and start making the changes that need to be made very quickly. I've been in conversation with a number of partners, good colleagues in this movement, everything from the National Religious Partnership for the Environment and Creation Justice Ministries affiliated with the National Council of Churches, and our great friends at Green Faith and Earth Ministry, and the wonderful people of Interfaith Power and Light. And for all of us, dealing with the climate emergency is at the top of the priority list. And we worked hard to stir up attention heading into the Paris talks, and we're now following through, trying to see how we can keep the pressure on and respond to the challenges that came out of Paris.
Yes, tell us about your feelings about the Paris Accord and whether it's sufficient, whether it's going to actually accomplish anything.
The Paris Accord is remarkable in the first place simply for happening. This is 195 countries with radically different interests and values and worldviews, all agreeing by consensus to every word of a 35-page document. And to get any agreement at all out of that sort of gathering is a remarkable achievement. And that agreement did set forth the standard that says we need to keep the temperature rise globally below 2 degrees Celsius, and it would be even better if we can hold it to 1.5 degrees. And each country is called on to make a pledge of what it will do to reduce emissions or to increase absorption of emissions and to ratchet those up every 5 years. So there's a process in place that will keep us moving more and more in the right direction. Now, the agreement is not sufficient. With the current level of pledges, the temperature rise that might be expected is somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 degrees, which is looking at catastrophe. But the process will keep us moving towards more stringent decisions, and there's a process to keep sort of the peer pressure on as countries challenge each other and hold each other accountable. So compared to the Copenhagen conference 6 years ago, where we had high hopes and got no results, we went into Paris with cautious hope and got something better than what many of us thought would be possible.
Now, President Obama and Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada have had talks recently that seemed modestly optimistic. What was your evaluation?
Trudeau is a marvelous improvement over his predecessor in our neighbor to the north. And he seems to really be taking the climate challenge seriously and recognizing Canada's role as a major producer of fossil fuels and a major emitter to bring strong response to that. And he and President Obama seem to be getting along well personally and to be really supporting each other in moving in the right direction on climate actions. That's the hope. They had a great series of meetings a week or so ago, and then just in the last couple of days, we see an announcement out of Washington that there's plans to open up new oil drilling in the Arctic Ocean. So it's a mixed report. Some good statements and some things going in totally the wrong direction, but that's the nature of politics.
I don't want to get diverted into the present presidential campaign. It's just really, you know, as they've called it, a clown car circus. And so I'm going to just give you 30 seconds if you want to say anything about it, but we're not going to dwell on it.
Clown car circus is a pretty good description. Yeah, the range of positions and personalities is astounding. Certainly there is a sense, both in the Republican and Democratic candidates, that there's large numbers of people who are fed up with the way things are, who are concerned about inequality, who have anxieties about where their lives are going, and those are being taken in two radically different directions. But the discontent among the electorate is something that's bubbling up in a way I've never seen before.
Well, I'd like to talk about some of your weekly commentaries, because every one of them is a gem, and I hope that more folks will read them. More specifically, your recent commentary about anxiety, that there's a difference between fear and anxiety, and maybe you can explain how you were coming about that and the fascinating response that you got to that commentary.
Well, thank you for lifting that one up. I also had somebody read it and say, oh, you need to be a part of a panel. And so 2 days ago, I was at a seminary discussion session talking about fear, anxiety, and environmental issues. So it's stirring up some interest. The topic came to my mind a month or so ago when I was on a different panel talking about climate change, and there was a climate scientist, and I was a religious activist, and there was a pastoral counselor, and we were all talking about our different perspectives on what's going on. And a person in the audience responded especially to the set of graphs that the climate scientist presented, showing the incredible changes that are happening and the likely effects that will come from that. And the person in the audience, Jeff, lifted up an idea that I'd heard before, saying that the fear those graphs stir up in us is not a good motivator for change. As he said, because fear is a very immediate reaction to very present danger. And so we react with fear in short-term, very quick response ways. And the list of responses is growing. The flight or fight reaction now gets talked about as fight, flight, freeze, or appease. Four different ways of responding to an immediate threat. But as Jeff said, the climate threat isn't an immediate one. It's generational. The things that frighten us are years and decades out. And so that flight or fight response doesn't take us anywhere helpful with the climate emergency. And that's what got me thinking about the role of fear and anxiety in our reactions to climate change. And that's how I stumbled across the new research that helped me understand that fear and fears are different from the response of anxiety, and that opens up some different possibilities for us.
Well, take that a little further, if you would. What are the possibilities for anxiety versus fear?
As I said, fear is the immediate runaway, freeze, fight, do something right off the bat to a very specific threat. Anxiety's more nebulous. The article where I first ran across this talked about walking down an unfamiliar street late at night and hearing sounds like somebody walking through the bushes behind you. It's not quite enough to get you to fear, but anxiety definitely kicks in. And that anxiety focuses your attention on what's happening around you. If you hear those sounds, you're going to stop looking at your cell phone or thinking about the shopping list, and you're going to pay very close attention to whether those noises are coming toward you or what else might be around you. And so if we take a step back from the response of fear and say anxiety about broader situations can be paralyzing. It can just stir us up into nervousness all the time. But it can also play a helpful role in getting us to concentrate our attention, to think more creatively about what we're doing and what we might be doing. And so anxiety can be perhaps a productive response when we encounter all of the diverse threats face us with climate change. It helps us to look seriously at what's happening and to pay attention to possible responses and do that in a longer-term way.
This sounds very psychological. We're dealing here with emotions, and emotions also play into our worship. I noticed in one of your commentaries recently, you were talking about the need to grieve and the need to include that grief in our prayers. Can you flesh that out a little bit for us?
One of the dangers in what I see in Protestant Christian worship these days in far too many settings is that it all happens from the neck up. It's a very cerebral, passive sort of approach to how we relate to God. And to bring our emotions into our worship experience and our spiritual development helps it become much more of a full person relationship. And as we look through scripture and the liturgies of the church through centuries, emotional things, fear, anxiety, grief, guilt, hope, hopelessness, are all very important themes that shape how we live our lives, how we understand ourselves, how we build our ethical systems. If we pretend that emotions aren't important, we're really missing out on an enormous part of the human and the spiritual experience. So yes, I'm a very strong advocate that to be relevant and to be transformational, Our worship these days needs to work very hard at connecting with those often uncomfortable emotions.
And how would a person pray to release or to expose that grief?
Oh, now you're asking the hard questions, Gerald. it needs to be a deeply personal experience, I think. A short collect out of the worship book probably is not going to get us there. But a worship experience that lets us take the time to reach back into our memories, to sit quietly and look inside ourselves and be honest about the emotions that are bubbling up there. Music can be a powerful piece of bringing out those emotions and making them more accessible to us. And the prayers, the worship experience needs to be very, very personal. It needs to talk about who I am, what I experience, and collective prayers. We have not done the things we ought to do. Prayers of confession don't really get us into the depths of guilt or grief or fear.
Well, let's take the other side of the coin. You've dealt with the personal. We have seemingly lots of people who are what we call euphemistically climate change deniers. And there's a lot of theories about why they are deniers. One could be that we're just such prideful people that we can't possibly lay claim to climate change, that it's just not our fault. But I'm wondering if you would address the topic of shame. I think that shame may be something that keeps people from feeling the guilt of being a climate changer. That is, someone who has, because of one's personal lifestyle, just created havoc in the atmosphere and at least played its part, voted for climate change just by our lifestyles, and thereby created a cycle whereby it's going to take a long time to recover, even if we made drastic changes right now. So can you address the topic of whether there's shame that's motivating climate deniers?
Before I get to that, let me toss in a statistic about the spread of climate beliefs. From some recent research from the Pew Forum, I think it is, talking about six different Americas of climate beliefs. And they run across a spectrum that they call alarmed, concerned, cautious, disengaged, I'm written off small type here, dubious, and denial, I think it is. So all the way from people like me who are deeply alarmed to folks who are aware and maybe thinking about doing something, and off to the far other extreme with those who say there's really no problem at all. And that study says that 41% of the U.S. population fits into the alarmed or concerned category, and 67% are in alarmed, concerned, or cautious. So two-thirds of the population is on some level of being deeply concerned, watching what's going on, wanting to see some sort of response happening. The notion that this is a 50-50 split between those who believe in climate change and those who don't is way off the base. So I find hope that there's a large contingent of people who are open to learning and open to acting. But that concerned and disengaged probably does have a lot of those people whose personal lifestyles and whose business lives are quite complicit in the problem being accentuated. People who travel a lot, who do not live voluntary simplicity in the language that you've taught me, and who feel some personal threat about the sort of changes that need to happen. And so people who are feeling caught up and attracted to business as usual are going to be less enthusiastic about making big changes in their personal lives and in the society around them. And actually, that loops back into the fear topic. Jeff, the questioner at the panel a month ago, said that climate change is a far-off thing and fear isn't a response. But our choices about how to act on climate change are very immediate situations that stir up lots of fear in segments of our population. I've been at several federal hearings recently commenting on proposed policies, and people from Colorado coal mining towns are absolutely petrified with fear at the possibility that their livelihoods and their communities will be shut down by changed energy policies. There is a very real, very immediate sense of fear that their way of life might be turned off. And on the flip side of it, I talk with people in Colorado whose local neighborhoods are having large oil and gas operations moving in with noisy and highly polluting fracking operations two blocks away from their house. And they're very fearful about those circumstances. So while a 6-degree temperature rise at the end of this century is abstract, the sort of immediate issues of energy policy are very close at hand and very emotionally powerful.
Thank you, Peter. I would like to get a little update also on your Not Ordinary Time campaign. Maybe you could summarize that campaign and tell what the prospects are for it for 2016.
The short summary is that it is on hiatus. This proved to be a much harder thing to pull together and to provide resources and do the publicity for than I'd anticipated. We had some great volunteers and some interest shown, but creating the whole set of materials that I envisioned was beyond our capabilities for the last year or so. And so we've sort of put it on the back burner, and we're thinking about different ways of how to approach the project. But something will be coming along in the next year or so, I'm sure. The background on that, if folks don't remember, is that we're saying to be relevant and meaningful in this day and age, Christian worship needs to pay close attention to the crises that are surrounding us and the ways that human civilization has changed so dramatically within the last 100 years or so. Issues like exploding human population, technologies of nuclear power and oil and gas extraction, genetic engineering, telecommunications, transportation, those have all changed the way that we think of ourselves, that we think of our world. They've changed the way that we relate to our local and our global neighbors, and I think they've changed the way that we live and experience our faith. And so our sense with Not Ordinary Times is that our theology and our worship lives need to start with the questions that emerge in our dramatically changed world. We've got some of the questions out there, and we're soliciting comments. We're running slow on getting the answers.
Just to put this in a little more context also, it fits in, it's almost a parody of the idea of ordinary time, that is the time that occurs after Epiphany up to Lent, and then also the time after Pentecost up to Advent. So there are two stretches of time during the church year that are called ordinary time. And my thought was that you were hoping that during the, quote, ordinary times, especially the non-festival times of the year, that people would focus on
the unordinary and make them not ordinary, but very focused on especially creation crisis issues.
That was the plan, and as you said, it was a play on words to take the ordinary time season from Pentecost to Advent and use that to pay attention to our not ordinary times. For those who revel in the technicalities of church language, the period of ordinary time doesn't mean that it's commonplace. It means that it's ordered in a series of numbered weeks. So it is definitely a play on words instead of a theological commentary at that level.
Very good. Well, I want to just encourage you in the strongest possible terms to keep up your good work. And I'm hoping that more folks will read your commentaries each week. They're free. They're delivered by email, and also to keep posted about not ordinary times. Peter, is there anything else you'd like to add for us before we sign off?
Well, if folks want to sign up for EcoJustice Notes or learn more about Not Ordinary Times, they can do that by looking at our fairly static website at www.ecojustice.org. That's ECO-justice.org. And there are links there to both Not Ordinary Times and EcoJustice Notes.
Now, there are a lot of other resources there as well from past years, and EcoJustice Ministries also has a fascinating and attractive Facebook page.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with Peter Sautel, Executive Director of EcoJustice Ministries. That's eco-justice.org. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click in window number 3. We've received an encouraging word from Tim Connor in regard to a recent podcast. Tim said, "Good interview. Educational alternatives presented to the public are essential today. Thanks for this program. Namaste." Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more basic information, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscription to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share-Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, "Live simply that others may simply live," as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Janzen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Simply live, learn to live simply so others can live.